Attention, attention all personnel. It's MASHcast.
Hello and welcome to MASHcast, the show that analyzes and celebrates episode by episode the greatest TV series of all time, MASH, which aired on CBS from 1972 to 1983. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, General Robert Iron Guts Kelly. And joining us this week in the VIP tent is Corporal Major Molly G. Hi, Molly. Welcome back.
Hi, Rob. Thank you for having me again.
Absolutely. And Lieutenant Phoebe M. Hi, Phoebe. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me. I've never been more excited for anything in my entire life.
I don't know if we should mention this or not mention it, but what the hell. One of us, Phoebe, is joining us all the way from Australia. So that's I don't know. I don't know why I'm so amazed by that, like technology or something. But still, it's just really cool. I'm getting to talk to somebody from Australia about MASH. So this is just fantastic. And so I'll peel back the tent flap a little bit further. So in terms of the time difference, that means Molly and I are up very early and Phoebe is up very late. But that is the sacrifice we're all willing to make to be here together to talk about this great episode of MASH.
You're here.
It's worth it.
Yeah, it absolutely is worth it. Okay, we're here to talk about the sixth episode of season eight, Period of Adjustment. That's a biggie. It originally aired on October 22nd, 1979. Now, of course, Molly has been on the show a couple times before, but Phoebe, this is your first appearance. So we do need to get into how did you become a fan of MASH?
Thank you so much for asking, Rob. I have known of MASH for basically as long as I can remember because it's one of my mom's favorite TV shows. She grew up watching it like here on TV in Australia and has a lot of very fond memories of it. And the first time I ever saw an episode of MASH for real was like, I remember just randomly walking into my parents' room one day and mom was watching a MASH rerun on the Turner Classic Movies channel. And for some reason, I just sat down and I started watching it with her. And it was actually the episode Bulletin Board from season three, which, you know, it ends with everyone having a great time, like splashing around in the mud and playing tug of war. And then the choppers come in and it's like, well, that's it. Fun's over. Everybody get back to work. And mom was sort of explaining to me like the premise of the show and like who the characters were and everything. But I remember so clearly her telling me like, that is the point of the show. Like that's the main idea, that no matter how much fun anybody's having and no matter what's going on in the camp, wounded are always coming and it's like always getting back to work. And, you know, something about that clearly stuck with me enough to remember it all these years later. But at the time, like after the episode was over, I don't remember how old I was, but I left the room and I moved on with my life. And I didn't think about MASH in any real way at all for a very long time. Until we fast forward to many, many years later, about mid 2020, it was COVID time and everybody was in lockdown and looking at their phones a lot and all kind of going a little bit insane. And somehow it like culminated in what was, from my point of view, like a mass hysteria event where seemingly overnight, every single person that I was following on Tumblr started watching MASH and posting about it in this really like rabid kind of unhinged way, which it really got me interested actually, because there's nothing more, like there's no recommendation on earth more powerful for me than when someone I follow on Tumblr is having a complete breakdown about something. And people were honestly talking about MASH like, oh man, it was like they were in witness protection and someone was coming for them. Do you know what I mean? There was a real like sense of urgency and like a real we know too much sort of energy to everybody's tone as they were discussing it and dissecting it. And at the same time, like the really fun part was like discovering this version of the show that existed collectively in our minds where every character is gay now. And I was like, this sounds like so much fun. I got to get in on this. And it was so funny to realize that the show everyone was like cracking it over was the same show as the one that my mom loved growing up that I'd seen an episode of. I was like, wait, you guys are talking about that old Army Doctor show like from a million years ago? That's okay. That's crazy. Sure. So I got into it and I looked up when it was on and I started watching reruns. And at the time it was like reruns would start at like 4:30 p.m. on a Sunday. And in my house, we started calling it the old people time slot because all the ads that would play were for like funeral insurance and like arthritis medication and like Werther's Originals. I felt very at home. It was very much my demographic. So that was how I was watching MASH for a while until I think around 2022 when it had been put on Disney Plus here. So mom and I decided to sit down and watch it together all the way from season one. And so this January just gone, New Year's Day 2025, actually, we finished season 11 and Goodbye for Willy Men. And I cried so much and for such a long time that I woke up the next morning feeling like I'd been hit in the face with a train. And the rewatch basically started right away, and now here we
Wow.
are.
I've already mentioned in previous episodes of the season, it is just amazing how much COVID was really
Yes.
responsible for a whole generation of people finding the show in a way they would not normally have done. Now, your mom helped, was very helpful in seeding it really early. I love that she really went to the premise for you. She's like, well, okay, but this is, they look like they're having laughs, but here's the thing. This is what's going on with the
Yeah, this
choppers
is
and all that. So that
serious.
was great. Yeah, this is very serious. I also love the idea that, of course, I know in other countries, Hulu doesn't really exist. It's all just Disney Plus. So I
Yes.
love the idea of MASH being on Disney Plus next to Disney movies and The Simpsons and all this stuff. And there's like this, we're going to do a show where people are having affairs and blood spurting out. It's all just all part of Disney Plus. It's all good. It's fine.
I always find it very funny when there's like ads on TV advertising Disney Plus, like, come here because we've got all the Marvel stuff and we've got all the Star Wars stuff. And I find it so frustrating that they're like, why are they not advertising the fact that they have the HD remaster of MASH?
Yeah,
People need
yes.
to know about this.
What's going on? Why are they burying the lead like this? Well, that's fantastic. And I also want to compliment both of you because you're both members of the MASH Blurb board, as you just talked about on Tumblr. And the two of you came to me early when we were deciding what episodes to do and said you'd like to do this together. And I just thought that was great because I thought it was very generous that you. Each one of you was like, oh, I'll sort of seed half the show for the other person. So again, all in the spirit of generosity that I think is a hallmark for a certain subset of MASH fans. Not everybody, certainly, but a certain subset. So again, thank you both for being here.
Yeah, no
That's very
problem.
kind of you, Rob. It was totally selfish on my part. I specifically was very, very excited to talk about this episode with Phoebe, who is also a member of the Beach Hive,
Yeah.
as I refer to it. So.
Right. Now, I mean, not only are you part of the MASH Tumblr subset, you're part of the subset of the subset, which is the Beach Hive, which is very, very focused on Mike Fowle slash BJ Honeycutt. And of course, this episode is a BJ episode like you would not believe. This one, we'll talk about it in a little, but I just want to give a little bit of context. This has always been one of my favorite episodes because for whatever reason, when I really hook into a show like you two have obviously done, I love TV shows that deal with their own history. I don't know why I find that so fascinating, but I do. And so anytime on MASH they would mention one of the older characters that had since gone, it always just as a kid, it always really fired my imagination of like, oh wow, they're referring to some character that maybe some of the audience doesn't even know who that is if they're not watching it. And so this episode deals with that in a huge way. Probably the biggest way that any episode has ever handled, except maybe Joker is Wild, and we'll talk about that when we get to season 11, another very beach-centric episode. So, okay, let's get right into it. As I mentioned, it originally aired on October 22nd, 1979. It was written by Jim Mulligan and John Rappaport, more about them in a minute, and it's directed by Charles S. Dubin. In the immediate aftermath of Radar leaving the 477, things are not going smoothly. Klinger hasn't quite gotten the hang of his new job as company clerk, so it's pretty chaotic. Potter's office is buried in paper, and he has to fend off calls from I-Corps about late or completely missing morning reports. Potter tries to cover, but he's so mad at Klinger that he considers that perhaps the job is too much for him. We can't all be radars, he offers, which hurts Klinger's feelings. Klinger delivers mail to the swamp, where BJ gets a letter from Peg, where she describes what it was like meeting Radar on his way home from Korea. Wearing his uniform, little Aaron Honeycutt saw Radar and exclaimed, "Hi, Daddy." During a session in OR, Hawkeye tries to get BJ to tell everyone about the meeting between Peg, Aaron, and Radar, but he doesn't seem to want to talk about it. Later in the mess tent, he sides with Klinger in being sick of everyone talking about Radar. Later that night, Winchester takes over for Hawkeye and Post-Op, and he warns Hawkeye that, back in the swamp, BJ is drunk, very drunk. Hawkeye goes back to the swamp, and after a few moments, he starts to get the idea that something is bothering BJ. He finally hits upon it, being the letter from Peg, and it quickly devolves into an argument. BJ gets furious and suggests that his missing his daughter, being stuck in Korea, is worse than what Hawkeye is going through missing his father. Hawkeye doesn't buy that, reminding BJ that he's been stuck at the 477th even longer than BJ has. Hawkeye then tries to get BJ to stop drinking, which sets him off. BJ smashes the still with a chair and punches Hawkeye in the eye. He immediately runs out of the tent. Potter and Margaret are searching for a now-missing Klinger and come to the swamp, only to find Winchester tending to the black eye Hawkeye has. They decide to team up and try to find both of them, with Margaret and Winchester going one way, Potter the other, with Hawkeye having to tend to a patient. During his search, Potter runs into Father Mulcahy, while Mulcahy explains to Potter that once, before he arrived, there was someone even worse than Klinger. This lad was quite a bozo, couldn't do anything right, drove everyone crazy with questions. You should have seen him try to put it through a call like it was hand-to-hand combat. Folks here were convinced the enemy had sent him here to sabotage the unit. Over time, he got a little better. Your late predecessor, Colonel Blake, rest his soul, took him under his wing and sort of helped him grow into the job. Potter realizes that Mulcahy was pulling one over on him. He's talking about Radar. Mulcahy asks, doesn't Klinger deserve the same time to get adjusted to the job? After all, he reminds Potter, when he arrived at the 47th, he got the broken-in model. Potter and Margaret meet back up and decide to call the MPs. But when they arrive, they find the totally smashed BJ and Klinger in Potter's office, smashing into his liquor cabinet. Potter asks Margaret to go fetch Hawkeye while Potter talks to Klinger alone. He sits Klinger down, and they clear the air. He admits that when he showed up at the 477th, people weren't jumping for joy over him since they all thought so much of Henry Blake. But everyone gave him time to make the job Sherman Potter's, since he was no Henry Blake, and I never tried to be. He decides that, as of this moment, Raider's office is closed, Klinger's is open. Klinger, relieved, passes out. Potter adds, all right, we'll open tomorrow. Hawkeye arrives and heads inside Potter's office to talk to BJ. BJ apologizes for hitting him and breaks down in tears when he thinks about the first time Aaron ever called anyone daddy, and it wasn't me. He admits that he's so jealous of Radar that he almost hates him. He also admits he's even jealous of Trapper, who he's never met, because he's home too. He collapses into sobs while Hawkeye promises, you'll go home. Someday we'll all go home. A few days later, Hawkeye and BJ rebuild the still with the help of Klinger, who got the necessary parts. They allow Klinger the honor of the first belt. Whew, that was a long, that was a longer description than I normally do, but this episode is so good, and I find it so fascinating that I probably went a little overboard when I wrote the synopsis, but there it is. So, Molly, let me start with you before we get into the breakdown of the scenes. Overall, what are your feelings about this episode and even this sort of era now? Because now we're in the final cast of MASH is set now. This is it. Radar's gone. This is the group we're going to have until the show ends.
Yes. Yeah. I'm surprised to hear you say that you really enjoy this episode, Rob, just based off of kind of your reaction to the BJ Papasan episode, which is another one where BJ's like kind of going through it. I remember you mentioning on that episode that you find it tough to watch. Personally, to me, this episode is catnip and I love that kind of stuff. I was worried I would overdose on this episode when I was watching it to prep. So yeah, like you say, it's just a BJ character deep dive like no other. And I'm really excited to get into it with you guys. And yeah, just season 8 in general. I love season 8. It again has just more and more like character centric stuff that I really find enjoyable to sink my teeth into. I'm a fan of them leaning more into the kind of darker subject matter. I know not everyone is, which is fair enough, but I think the season 8 episodes where they experiment heavily with the format are two of the best episodes of the show, Lifetime and Dreams. And I think they're just doing amazing stuff this season. So yeah, that's what I think.
Agreed. Phoebe?
I also think this episode is like catnip. Very accurate. Very well described. It has all my favorite things in it. I'd forgotten how funny it was when I was rewatching it yesterday. I was surprised at how often I was laughing out loud. Like it's a very funny episode, but it's also deeply depressing. And I love sad episodes. I love when they're all crying and fighting and getting drunk and falling over. And I love when BJ and Hawkeye fight. And I love when BJ has a breakdown, because it always reveals strange things about his twisted little rat maze of a brain. And you know, this is actually a very special episode, Rob, I'll tell you, because this period of adjustment, okay, has the highest number of appearances of the word Beej as spoken by Alan Alda in the entire series, with 8 total instances of Beej. So yeah, this episode is an all-timer. It's amazing.
I'm glad you clocked that. For either one of you, I don't know how you're watching it. Phoebe, maybe you're watching it Disney Plus. I don't have Hulu anymore. I did, but I don't. So when I just again to pull back the tent flap, I have digital files of every episode, and that's how I watch. That's how I watch them on Apple when I'm just watching them for pleasure or whatever. But if I'm on my computer, I have digital files that I'm accessing. And when I play this one, it still features the also starring Gary Berghoff as Radar credit, which makes no sense because he's not on the show anymore. And I don't, is that true for either one of you? Did you see that credit when you rewatched this one?
I'm going to pull up my copy of it right now. I also have digital files, and I was recently gifted the box set. So I was watching it on DVD when I watched it this most recent time. But Phoebs, is that something you remember?
I'm looking at it right now. It says also starring Gary Berghoff as Radar. It actually does.
What? Yeah. What? Like, what is that? I don't understand that. I mean, like, why? I mean, I know that there's a really wonderful caricature of him in this episode, but he's not actually in the show. So very, very, very strange. So, okay. The show opens up with Klinger, with Potter talking to Ikor and talking about how, you know, he understands how frustrated everyone must be that they're not getting the report. So we see his office is an absolute disaster. There's piles of paper all over the place. Now, I will say, we know that Klinger's a slob, and he is just, you know, papers pile up sort of just force majeure kind of thing around him. Now, you know, Potter could clean up his own office. I have to say, like, I don't know, he's allowing Klinger to let the office be so bad, but okay, fine. He gets so frustrated, he grabs a pile of paper and he throws it up because he's just like, well, what the hell? And so he stops Klinger, who is in the middle of doing the mail, and, you know, he's obviously furious, and he talks about the thing about Ikor. He says, you know how they feel? They actually expect to see morning reports every morning. It would be nice if they got one from us once in a while. Now, can either of you explain to me how morning reports work? Because do they really have somebody coming every day to pick up a morning report? Are they really sending somebody all the way from wherever that is? Ikor? Like, that seems kind of, it's not like it's a mail route. I don't know. That always felt a little strange to me that how would Ikor even notice if there's no morning report filed for at least a couple of days?
Like good old army efficiency. Great stuff.
I guess.
You're asking the wrong person, Rob.
Yeah, okay. Completely.
I mean, well, I figured that either one of you with your fanciful notions of the show, you might have come up with some in-story reason as to why this is happening. But again, I don't understand. They're not emails. They're actually paper reports that they have to send out. But okay, that's fine. So
I guess maybe they would wire them, but I don't know. I mean, telegrams were pretty expensive back in the day.
It's very odd. So whatever, it's fine. So Potter has a wonderful old-timey folksy aphorism at one point. Now, I generally don't like those. I don't find them that funny, I guess. The whole horse hockey and cow critter or whatever he calls them, you know. I just kind of go, all right, fine. And I think the show leaned into it much heavier in later seasons. This one, though, I do say makes me laugh, where he says, "You have done your job with all the efficiency of a one-legged man at a butt-kicking contest," which is
so good. I love his strange, folksy exclamations. I love that he'll say the strangest, like, bumpkin-sounding things, but in this really, like, stern, barking voice. So that makes me laugh every single time. I love that.
Harry Morgan gets a lot of great line deliveries this episode.
He does. Yeah. I guess there's something about the idea of a butt-kicking contest, which just makes me laugh, right? Because it's like, well, why would that even be a thing? So there's a kind of, like, Dada-esque humor to it that I sort of enjoy. So, okay. Now, right after he says to Klinger, you know, "We can't all be radars," Klinger retorts with, "And we can't all be sensitive to underlings' feelings. If you're through insulting me, I have to go deliver the mail," which is a great response, right? Because it's like he's just letting him know, even though he's his boss, that you're really hurting my feelings. And in the syndicated version, which I, again, go on and on and on and on about, it cuts at that point and it goes to the next scene. But in the full version, there's a whole runner of Klinger pulling pieces of mail out, and it's for Potter. And he turns around and he's like, "Potter, S." And then he walks away.
Right.
"Potter, yeah. S." And it's a whole comedy beat that the episode that I saw for so many decades didn't have. And I have to say, I actually kind of like the version I saw, because it ends with no joke. It ends on Klinger just being hurt, which to me gives it a little more resonance. But, you know, okay. It is funny that we see maybe why Klinger is not good at his job, because he's clearly not doing this in an efficient manner.
You know, the first time I watched this episode and this scene, I really thought Klinger was setting up a scam here, where he would be like he was pulling like a weaponized incompetence thing, where he was being really bad at the job on purpose so that everyone would get sick of it quicker and then find a different clerk. But yeah, spoilers, he's not doing that. He's just genuinely very bad at it.
I would laugh at the phrase weaponized incompetence, but that's what I'm currently living through at the moment. So we'll just put that off to the side. Speaking of weaponized incompetence, Klinger delivers some mail to Margaret, and she wants to know about these forms that she submitted. And he says there's a perfectly logical reason why Potter hasn't seen those requisitions. Why is that? And then he proudly says, "I lost them," which always makes me laugh. He's so proud of that.
Great line. I love Margaret there, because she like delivers this mini monologue. It's almost in one breath entirely. It's very impressive.
It's a great bit, right? It's the idea that like Klinger knows he's bad at his job, but at the same time, it doesn't bother him on some level, because he's just I just love that. I just the read on "I lost them" is so great by Jamie Farr. You know, there are a million different ways to play that, but the way he's just so. That was originally going to be the audio clip I was going to play at the episode, but I found another one another joke I liked even more. But just, "I lost them." It's like, well, check and
checkmate, Margaret.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly. Don't you feel dumb, Margaret? I kind of think so. he then goes to the swamp, and Klinger's very snarly. Both Hawkeye and BJ sort of notice that, and they're kind of like giving him a little bit of concern, but also a little like, all right, Klinger, relax. We see that BJ has got a letter, and it's got some sort of like a little crumbly sound in it. And we find that it's because his daughter included a cookie, which smashed along the way, all the way over to Korea. And we even see Mike Farrell has this great bit of comedy bit where he, as the other actors are talking, he's shoving the cookie crumbs down his throat.
Chewing.
Yeah. And then Hawkeye says, "Is there another letter? There must be milk in there." Winchester shows up and is furious to find that his mail is outside the swamp on the ground, which I imagine he'd be pretty mad about, especially since, you know, there's probably a good chance there's money in there.
When when Jamie Farr is like, okay, so I dropped it, he drops some more mail. Like you can see some more mail like fall out of his hand as he says that, which
I never
like the
noticed
physical
that.
comedy in this episode is so good.
I've never noticed that. That's great. Somebody else not getting their mail on time. Oh boy.
I love the way Charles says, I found them outside on the ground.
He's so
On the
offended.
ground.
He's so offended. He's just so offended, which is again, it's understandable. And then he then rubs the salt in the wound even further, where he says, you know, I never realized what a little, you know, I would imagine that Colonel Potter would have replaced you before now with the, you know, something a little more intelligent, like some plant life or something. And he says, I never, I, you know, now I fully appreciate, you know, radar, the job that radar did. And then, so then we go to Beach and he's reading the letter and he says, sure is a cute little guy and so nice. Sweetheart, it was really funny. When Erin first saw radar in his uniform, she ran up to him and said, hi, daddy. And at that exact moment is when Winchester starts to talk, because he says, out of the mouth of babes comes drollery, which is, first of all, he's insulting a small child. And it was like, good Lord, Winchester. But he's out of focus as he's talking. We're still on Mike Farrell. And we see BJ's face just freeze. And I love that moment. I love that if you're not paying attention, you don't really notice it, because he doesn't, you know, he doesn't overdo it, of course, because he's a good actor. But I just love that his face freezes, because as we all know, that this is like a dagger in his heart. And I want to ask both of you about this, because we've covered this on other episodes. Does Erin, excuse me, not Erin, that's the daughter. Does Peg not know her husband at all? Right? Would you include that? How does she not know that that is like a kick in the face to him?
I mean, well, they've never really been in this situation before, so maybe he wasn't always like this. Maybe this is just, because of the circumstances. Maybe she doesn't actually realize that this has become such a big problem for him while he's over here, over here being Korea.
I guess that's possible. I mean, we talked about it in the episode where she mentions the neighbor making a pass at her, and it maybe that's getting to this this sort of subtext that she doesn't fully understand her husband in this context, because she, as you just said, Phoebe, like they've never dealt with this before. But like in that episode, I was sort of marveling, like, really? She would tell him that? She would think that's funny? And this is another one. I'm just like, maybe keep that to yourself. I
Yeah,
don't
maybe a
know.
little.
You know, I don't know. Am I being too harsh on Peg Honeycutt, Molly? I don't know.
I don't think it's harsh. It's interesting that you brought up the mail call episode because that was also one that we did together. And I think, that was really the first time when BJ started to realize, like, oh, we're kind of growing into two different people having been away from each other for so long. Maybe it is just that, Peg, this is a version of BJ that Peg doesn't know and isn't familiar with, and things that would they would be able to laugh about if he was there, are in a very different context now. So I maybe it's, just the kind of thing where she's like, oh, if BJ was here, we would think this was funny. So I'm going to share it with him because we think it's funny. But not so much.
Right. And you know, again, we have seen the evolution of the BJ character. I don't have to tell the BJ Hive, members of the BJ Hive, about that. But I mean, obviously, when he arrived at the 407, he was much sweeter and more genial. And over the course of the later seasons, he, Mike Farrell, brings a real edge to it. And that could be, that's the result that is comes from BJ being in this place for a while. And maybe, yeah, Peg doesn't see that side of it. Maybe he hides that when he talks to her, when he writes his letters. We don't know.
I absolutely think he hides it when he. I don't think he tells her any of the or most of the bad stuff. I don't think that he writes home about that. So
Yeah, that boy's a liar. He's a liar. He's lying all the time.
He is.
Okay, sorry, you two have obviously had spent some time thinking about this. You think that he just writes letters to Peg, and it's all Hawkeye did this. That was really funny. And Klinger dressed like Cleopatra, and it's all that. He's not telling him about, you know, well, I had to cut a guy's leg off the other day.
A good 80 to 85% of the content of what he's writing home. Yeah, I don't think he wants to let her know how much it's really getting to him.
I mean, yeah, you know, people talk about that having long distance relationships are very hard, and they are. I tried one once, didn't work, and you know, imagine being in a marriage and then all of a sudden being forced to being part of a long distance relationship that you're like, well, I didn't sign up for this. We don't necessarily know how to navigate this, especially when there's a young baby involved. So yeah, it could be that Peg just writes these Peg's writing style might be more stream of consciousness, right? Like she might just be like, oh, and then we did this. And then the neighbor hit on me. Wasn't that funny? Anyway, blah, blah, blah. Meanwhile, BJ is filtering out the horror because he just doesn't want to send that stuff back to Mill Valley. I don't know. So anyway, Hawkeye says, well, what else is in the letter? And he just says, oh, she goes on with some other stuff. And that drives Klinger nuts because Klinger is like, radar, radar, radar. That's all I hear about. And he storms out.
Yeah. And when they cut away to that wide shot, you can still see like Mike Farrell is like sitting there, jaw clenched, staring at the letter while everyone else is kind of going on with the scene. I think they do a really great job of like both framing it with the camera and like the acting work as well, that kind of no one notices the thing that has like set BJ off. But to us, it's very clear.
So we then go into the operating room and everyone's talking about the letter and Hawkeye tries to get BJ to, well, actually, before I even do that, Margaret continues berating Klinger, calling him a clown. And, you know, Margaret, okay, like all right, give it a little bit of a break. Even Winchester, the two of them really pile on, which, you know, I appreciate the show is willing to have our main characters not always be pleasant. Because they're really being kind of vicious, even to the point where Mulcahy steps in and says, you know, I really think you're all kind of being a little hard on Klinger, which is very un-Mulcahy to do, right? He's very mindful of the boundaries that are sort of there in terms of his rank and things like that and his place at the unit. But I like that they're seeding that where he's the one who's kind of going, "What? All right, everybody. Relax a little bit." I think that's terrific. And of course, it's going to lead to a fantastic scene later on. But I like that. First of all, I like it that when Father Mulcahy, he gets more to do. But I also like that he's the sort of conscience of everybody going, all right, can everybody settle down a little bit? I think that's really sweet.
Yeah, it is very sweet of him. I like how, well, so this whole episode, they've gotten very meta in terms of, they knew that the audience was going to be missing Radar with a vengeance. You know, Radar was a very beloved character and they knew like this is his first episode gone and the audience is going to be feeling some kind of way about it. And I like their choice to kind of comment on that by having the characters feel the same way, which I just really enjoy the choice. I think it has some great implications when we get into later scenes as well. And yeah, when Potter says, he's like, oh, you know, it's not Klinger's fault. We all just got used to the way Radar handled things. It's like he thinks he's being nice about like, well, it's not really Klinger's fault. We just miss Radar. But yeah, as Mulcahy points out, it's like they really are all being very hard on Klinger for, you know, something that no one really kind of has control over. Yeah.
So Hawkeye says to, you know, tells everybody, hey, you know, Beach got a letter from Beach. I'm saying it myself. Beach got a letter from Radar and we see that BJ just kind of shoves it off. And he's like, oh, he met my kid for a couple hours. Like, it's clearly I don't want to talk about this. And there's one point where Hawkeye makes a joke to BJ and BJ doesn't even respond. And he's just talking to Margaret about it, Clamp or whatever the hell they're doing. So obviously things are, you know, pretty irritated with BJ and Hawkeye is not picking up on that at all. Now he might just be, he's busy. He's got other things on his mind, but he's for considering how good friends they are, he's not figuring out his best friend is just not acting normal. I guess we see BJ's not being his normal jovial self. So, by the way, this is kind of, you know, the brief reminder, the show does take place at a hospital. Because, like, this episode really features very little medicine in it.
I just want to point out the way they frame the shot of Hawkeye and BJ in OR. BJ is in the same position and frame where he was when we saw him read the letter, when he had that moment where his face falls.
True.
Like, Hawkeye's kind of a little bit out of focus in the background the way Charles was in that shot. So I just think that was a very cool directorial choice. And yeah, you really do see that the volcano that is BJ is just bubbling away under the surface there, and Hawkeye really doesn't have any idea.
Yeah, speaking of clenching a jaw, like, you can see it, when BJ clenches his jaw from around his mask at some point in that scene. It's so good.
I that's another thing I didn't notice. So yeah, good props to Charles S. Dubin, who did like 50 of these, that he finds little things to you know, suggest with the camera moves.
Yeah, Dubin's a pro. There's some really great shots in this episode that I like a lot.
Yeah, so yeah. then we go to the mess tent, and we see that BJ is sort of staring off into space. He's not even really paying attention in the chow line. Klinger asks for, like, double portions of food. Winchester and Margaret go after him again and insult him. Again, they are really, really, really going overboard. There's a great bit of physical comedy where Igor is trying to spoon a whole thing of, like, corn or something onto Margaret's tray. She keeps moving out of the way, so he keeps almost, and then he finally actually just dumps it on the ground because Margaret moves out of the way too fast. It's a nice case, a little bit of physical comedy.
I love that moment so much. Actually, at the very beginning of this scene, when, as you say, Rob, BJ's kind of like staring into space, and then he sort of snaps out of it. And when Igor asks him if he wants more food, he's like, no, I'm good, and walks away. Charles, you can see, kind of like notices this happen, and he kind of like watches BJ walk off with a little like, huh, I wonder what that was about expression. And then, like, very quickly moves on from it. But I love the background acting in this episode so much.
Definitely.
So Klinger then tries to sit down with everybody as he normally would. And Margaret says, he says, I want to go where I'm appreciated. And Margaret says, there's an empty one over there. Margaret. Okay.
They're just like full, like, middle school girls fighting at this point.
They're really piling on.
I mean, come on, Margaret, stop trying to make fetch happen. Like, what are you doing? I mean, give him a break, you know? And then once again, Mulcahy says, you know, I really think you're overdoing it a little bit. And then, of course, BJ kind of chimes in it from another direction, saying, radar, radar, radar. That's all anybody wants to talk about. Can we talk about something else? Even Peg, radar was here. Radar's so cute. Aaron loves radar. And the contempt that is dripping out of his voice.
This is when the catnip starts kicking in. It's about this part where you can tell that, oh yeah, BJ's going crazy. This is going to be good. This is going to be great.
Yes. Oof. It's like, BJ, admit that you are like a person with problems and things bother you. And you can't just like stuff that all down and be like, it's going to be fine, because it's going to explode out like this.
Oh my God. He says some crazy things in this scene when he says radar's gone now. Can't we forget about him? Like, it's what a terrible thing to say to these people who are like, in a way, they're kind of like grieving their friend who's gone home that they won't see anymore. And yeah, it really shows that how much he's genuinely hurting over what's happened and how much he's trying to like keep it in, but it's like spilling out, you know. And there's also the line where he says, like, right before he storms off, he says, it's not like Radar's dead, he's better off than we are. Oh my God.
And that line is so loaded with subtext when you think about this episode being a commentary on Radar leaving the show, and in context of other characters who have left the show, like, for example, Henry, who is dead now. And it's like, okay, well, why are we so upset? It's not like Radar died or anything. Like, it could be worse. Get over it, guys.
It's crazy. It's crazy.
It's crazy stuff. And yeah, and the way he just like storms off afterwards, it's like, what is your problem?
I love that he's sort of like tearing at the bread angrily, and then he just kind of dumps it on his tray and walks off. And it's again, it's an interesting idea that Hawkeye, I mean, obviously this will prove to be incorrect in the last episode, but Hawkeye seems to be dealing with his stress better in that he lets it rip every so often, as opposed mm-hmm. to BJ, who is stuffing it way down. In fact, there's a bit my wife and I do with one another. We're both Irish, but she jokes about that, like my family is particularly emotionally stunted, which is not entirely incorrect. And every so often something will come up where it's something with my family where we're not discussing something, and my wife just goes, just stuff it way down. Just keep stuffing it way down. Yeah, kind of. That's sort of what's going on. So I do feel like BJ a little bit here, where it's like, all right, he's just so frustrated about something. So
I'm Irish too. I totally get it.
There you go. So then we go to the post-op, and Hawkeye is tending to a patient. We see Nurse Baker, played by Jan Jordan, who actually gets quite a few lines in this episode. There's a really great moment where they're talking, and then Winchester shows up, and Hawkeye and Winchester have a little back and forth, as they normally do. And Hawkeye says, Winchester kind of throws a lob at Hawkeye, and you know, vaguely insulting him, and Hawkeye responds with, the man's a regular Mayo brother. And Jan Jordan, as Baker, has this wonderfully mellifluous laugh.
Aww.
And she actually laughs twice. She chuckles, and then she chuckles, like, again. And it is the most genuine response. I mean, it's got to be acting, because she has to know the line is coming. But laughing on screen is hard to do, because it has to seem genuine. And she really, if I didn't know better, I'd say that was an ad lib and she's responding to it. Now I know that that's not true, but good on her for her. Like, she only get, you know, Jan Jordan never got much more than one or two lines on the show, but she really, I don't know. I always found it to be very charming. Just the way she goes, oh, she just finds Hawkeye very funny. I thought that was great.
Yeah, I love little moments with the minor characters where you kind of get reminded that, like, oh yeah, they are also here all the time as well, and like interacting with our main characters every day, and they have, you know, rapport with them and stuff that is just not the focus of the show. Mm-hmm. But they do a really good job with that.
Yeah, they're real people with like real lives. Oh my God, you forget sometimes.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, Nurse Baker's got her whole life going on, right? I always find that to be real. At parts, like, she's in the foreground, and the way her head cocks back, it's just very charming. I just was like, wow, good for you. I mean, it would make the most of the little they gave you to do, you know, like, that's great. So Hawkeye says he's going to go back to Swamp, and Winchester points out that, well, you got to be careful, because BJ is awash in that homemade brew swill of yours. And Hawkeye is like, very droll, Winchester, I've seen BJ drink before. And, oh, very boring, Charles. I've seen BJ drink before. And then I love that Winchester shows some genuine concern. Mm. Where he's like, Pierce, not like this. And I love that. I love that it's, you're getting this like, oh, geez, something's up. You know, I love that. And Winchester's actually showing some level of concern for these guys, for both of them, for saying, first of all, BJ's drinking a lot, and Hawkeye, you better be a little mindful of it. I think that's a great little moment.
Yeah, it's like carrying on from that moment in the mess tent before, when you can see mm-hmm. that he notices that BJ's not acting right, and he's obviously remembered it, and he brings it up again. It's a really, really good little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. So Hawkeye goes to the swamp, and we see, in fact, yes, BJ is really, really drunk. Hawkeye's trying to why are we cheering at that?
Yay, I love this scene where
the good stuff happens.
Okay. This is my favorite scene in whole episode.
The meat of the episode.
Okay. So
even more than when BJ's crying, this is the scene.
I can't wait to unpack this. I'm fascinated in that. All right. So they're arguing back and forth, and then finally it comes out, and Hawkeye's like, oh, it's the letter. And BJ's like, yeah, the letter. I'm sorry that if that annoys you, I have this strange aversion to being away from my family. And then Hawkeye tries, you know, it's the same for all of us. You don't think I miss my father? And then that leads BJ and Mike Farrell, man, the single on him, where it's just him looking at Hawkeye, and he's so full of contempt in this moment for his pal, because he's like, you really think that's the same? Come on, Hawkeye. How old is your father? How old? And Hawkeye's like, 62. 62. And he's like, does he remember what you look like? Was he walking and talking when you left? You know, well, last I heard, Aaron wasn't. And by the way, Mike Farrell stumbles on the line.
Yes.
How old was he? He goes, how old was he? Like, he doubled. And I love that they left it in, because of course he's drunk, and it makes so total good. Sense.
Yeah.
This is one of those scenes where I watch it and I am like, I want to find out where you two are on this. I'm 50-50 because it's not the same. It's not the same. It's not remotely the same. At the same time, how dare you, as Margaret will say to BJ in a later episode, how dare you say that your suffering is worse than anybody else's? So it really is like, I see both sides here. And especially I love that when he says that, that pisses Hawkeye off. I love that Hawkeye is like, okay, I've had enough. And I almost want him to say, I've been here three seasons longer than you have, BJ.
I mean, he kind of does. He can't really say it in those words exactly.
Right.
But yeah, no, I totally agree with you about the 50-50 thing, Rob. Mm-hmm. I think those are kind of the best scenes when there's a conflict and neither person is wrong, but just the way that they're handling it is very messy and very flawed and very human. So yeah, it's tough to watch, but this is one of my all-time favorite scenes. Mm-hmm. Phoebe, you want to jump in?
I definitely agree about the 50-50 thing. I think BJ does make a point here, because it is kind of different for him, since he's missing like so much formative stuff in Aaron's life as compared to Hawkeye being away from his dad. I guess it doesn't have the same like urgency. So there is a difference in their experiences, but I do think that what they have in common and what they all have in common should be more of a comfort to BJ than he's letting it be in that moment. Like they all want to go home. They all miss their families. Hawkeye just, he wants to be a friend. He wants to empathize and offer comfort. But BJ's like, no, I'm experiencing horrors beyond your comprehension right now. So don't even try. Yeah, it's great. you can definitely see where they're both coming from.
I like the line that you pointed out earlier, Rob, where BJ is like, oh, I'm sorry if it annoys you that I miss my family, which is like, obviously that's not what Hawkeye is saying. It was totally uncalled for. It's just BJ lashing out. But I think it kind of speaks a lot about what BJ thinks Hawkeye thinks of the idea of settling down and raising a family.
Mm.
I think BJ is like, oh, obviously, like, you wouldn't understand because, like, you're a bachelor and this, you know, you just can't understand this. I think what this episode so effectively builds up to with BJ is some of these things he's bottled up for a long time, and they're not even directly related to the letter, but they're now just kind of boiling over with everything else.
So true.
And I'm guessing if the Beige Hive contingent of Mash Blur, again, the subset of the subset of the subset, is fascinated with the idea that, like, the layer of, oh, all these characters are gay that you are putting over, that you guys like to put over it. This is like, this is a couple far fighting with one another. I mean, this is, you know, these two know each other on a level that most friends don't, is kind of reserved, not reserved, that's not the right word, but this is a level of intimacy that most people don't get unless they're in a romantic relationship. It's, you know, this kind of thing. Because I love the idea that, like, other annoyances that have been under BJ's skin is now all just bubbling up. It's not just the letter.
It's that thing where you're in an argument with someone who you're, you know, in a committed relationship with, romantic, otherwise, whatever. And, like, the thing, you get into an argument about something that then becomes an excuse to, like, unload everything that you've ever been annoyed about with this person.
No, sorry, you go ahead.
So no, I was just going to say, I definitely think that's what we're seeing with BJ here.
Yes. And I think related to that, this would be a great time to bring up BJ dad theory if we're
Oh
talking
my
about
God.
like this scene being about other things that BJ's thinking about outside the letter, but they're all sort of bubbling up here. If you would like to hear another crackpot theory, Rob, we
Oh,
definitely have one to
absolutely.
share.
What's BJ Dad? I'm here for it. What's BJ Dad
Can I
theory?
take this? Can I take this for a minute, Phoebe?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Go
Okay.
ahead.
So, Rob, this scene, which is already messed up, becomes even more messed up if you watch it with the assumption that BJ doesn't have a close relationship or even a good relationship with his own father.
Period.
And what we mean by this, so throughout the show, BJ hardly ever talks about his parents. We don't really see him mention them. When he does mention them, it's never anything good. Like, there's that one line in season four where he's like, "Oh, my dad wouldn't let me play with any toys that resembled a gun, and I was miserable until I discovered dolls," which is like probably a joke. I don't think that's what really happened.
Boy's a
There's
liar.
another line. Yes, he is a liar in season six where he's like, "I used to sleepwalk, but my mother cured me by scattering tacks on the floor," which again, probably a joke. I don't think that actually happened, but like, it just the little like tidbits that we get when BJ does mention his parents, it's kind of like, okay, that's like a weird thing to say.
Oh,
And
it's a
then by
very
contrast,
interesting joke.
yeah, very interesting joke. By contrast, we see that he's super close with his in-laws. He has a
Yes.
very good relationship with Peg's parents,
Yes.
which again, like makes the absence of like him mentioning his own parents just stand out that much more. So if we assume watching this scene that BJ is not close with his own father, a couple of things. A, he has to feel that much more terrible about not being there for Aaron because he knows what it's like to not have a good relationship with your father. B, it must irritate him that much more when Hawkeye compares BJ missing Aaron to Hawkeye missing his dad, who he has an amazing relationship with.
Exactly.
And then C, if BJ has indeed distanced himself from his own parents and his in-laws are now kind of occupying that space in his family life, it makes perfect sense that he has this secret fear that Aaron is going to replace him with another father figure if he fails her. So
It's all
yeah, that's
connected.
the BJ dad theory.
I'm loving this.
Yeah,
I'm really loving this crack pottery. This is
it is
absolutely.
amazing how well it works in this scene,
It would.
because it's incredible. It's like literally saying him, you don't get what it's like to miss your wife and child, but you also don't get what it's like to grow up hating your dad. Like the physical distance and the lost time between you and your dad is not going to cause any emotional distance. But not only am I missing out on important milestones for my kid, but if I don't fix it, which I can't because I'm stuck here, then yeah, our relationship will be ruined. And she's not gonna want me or need me in her life. She's gonna end up feeling towards her dad like I do to mine. One day she won't even talk to her closest friends in the world about me. It'll be like I don't even exist. They won't even know my real name. Oh my God. See, it's real. It's so real.
We've spent way too much time thinking about this.
No, clearly not. One of the things I love about clever crack pottery theories like this one is that it doesn't obviate anything that's been said. It's clearly you have all put way too much thought into this, but it doesn't it there's nothing in the show that stops what you're saying from being wrong, which is
You can't
great,
prove it
right?
didn't
Which is
happen.
great. Because
I'm
okay,
not crazy, and neither is anybody else.
exactly. So okay, again, let's unpack. We're going to pause the episode here for a moment. We're going to unpack this a little bit, everybody. If anyone listening to this, if you don't want to hear this, hit the fast forward button. Probably like 2 minutes, and then we'll resume.
Only 2 minutes?
Or
Jeez.
maybe two. I'm trying to be generous. 2 minutes. So okay, we did learn in the first episode, Welcome to Korea, BJ's first episode, that his dad is also a doctor. Which I,
Actually, so
what?
yeah,
Allegedly.
he doesn't say his dad is a doctor in Welcome to Korea. First, he says he comes from three generations of doctors, which is not the
Okay.
same thing.
Okay. All right. That's true. All right. Well, okay. That's a detail that they never bring back, right? And I have to think that was an offhanded line. And I think maybe the writers, if they ever even thought about it, probably went, well, wait, we have that with Hawkeye. Why are we doing that? Like, we're both families of doctor, so no, like they probably that's probably a line that if they had ever thought to undo it, they would have undone it. Two, You're right. We don't hear about his family hardly ever, other than we know his dad's name is Jay and his
I
mom's
don't
name
believe
is
that for a
B,
second,
which
by
may
the
not
way.
even be true, but that's what we hear, right? So,
Straight up rhubarb pie. That is
and
not true.
then, cow cookies. And then the third, the kind of bouncing off the point that you made, Phoebe, is the episode, The Colonel's Horse, where he does, oh, excuse me, Molly, you made this point, where he calls Peg's family, and he calls Peg's dad, I think he calls him dad or pa,
Pa, yeah,
right?
pa. Yeah, pops or something.
Okay, now that I will say, that is something that as an obsessive MASH fan, I noticed because I call my mother-in-law mom. I call her that now. She because that is a it is a expression of affection and respect, and I know that she likes it. Like I know that it makes her feel good when I call her that, even though she's clearly not my mother. But nevertheless, it is a suggestion of closeness that you don't necessarily have with other, like my father-in-law. I don't call him dad, I call him by his name because that's just the relationship we have. I get a lot, him and I are very close, but we just don't have that same kind of thing. But I call my mother-in-law mom when I say that. Except when she's being ridiculous and I make fun of her and I call her by her first name. But that's a whole separate thing. But that's interesting. I like that that nugget is there if you want to explore it, and you and the rest of the BJ obviously have explored it with like a jeweler's loop digging in, So I like all that. And the other thing about this scene is, yeah, Hawkeye missing his father is not the same as you missing your child when your child is literally, turning from an infant to a toddler. But one anxiety that Hawkeye has that BJ does not is actuarial tables, right? Because odds are Aaron is going to be alive when BJ gets home. There's a chance that Ben Pierce won't. And that could be an anxiety that hangs on Hawkeye that BJ can't understand. Because, yeah, I mean, we say that he's 62. That's not that old. I say that because I'm close to it. But I mean, like, but you know what I mean? It's not like he's 90. But still, this was also in the 50s. People didn't live as long. So that's an anxiety that Hawkeye is dealing with. And we know from other episodes that he is incredibly close with his father. And so that I like that idea that like BJ and I like that again, once again, I like that let the characters be human in that, yes, I totally sympathize with BJ, but he is being a bit of a jerk here. He really is. So
Total jerk.
yeah. So I love it. I love this theory that you all concocted. This is fantastic.
It's very real. It
We're
feels
glad
so
you like
real.
it, Rob.
I
Okay.
just want to say something else fascinating to me about kind of Hawkeye's reaction to BJ here. Because we see that what has set BJ off is this fact that Radar had this special moment with Aaron that BJ is jealous of. There's other episodes where they kind of explore BJ feeling insecure about his marriage and insecure about his relationship with Peg, but this one is clearly about him feeling like he's feeling insecure as a father. So it stands out to me when BJ snaps at Hawkeye and he's like, "Oh, tell me how much you miss your kid." Hawkeye's response is, "I don't have a kid and I don't have a wife." BJ isn't talking about Peg at all in this scene. Hawkeye is the one who felt compelled to bring her up. So to me, it mirrors the conversation they have later in the episode where BJ mentions someone seemingly out of nowhere that has nothing to do with the conversation, but actually, in fact, has everything to do with what they're really arguing about. So kind of more on that when we get to that scene.
Yeah, put a pin in that
Wow. Okay. So everybody, welcome to hour two of this dissection of this 24-minute episode. So anyway, I love all this. But this is why I had you on, is for this kind of crackpottery. So this is
This is
fantastic.
why we wanted to be on, Rob. We're
There you
so
go.
happy.
Yeah.
This is so important.
So BJ throws his martini glass, and I love it's a great prop because it explodes in a really beautiful way. You know, it doesn't just kind of fall, like it actually pieces fly in all directions. It's a great, you know, Mike Farrell really hurls it with some force. I mean, I'm sure it's like, it's that sugar glass or whatever they call it. That's not real glass, but it explodes in a really dramatic way. And then BJ grabs a chair, smashes the still. Hawkeye tries to grab him, and then BJ actually punches Hawkeye in the face. And that is our act break. And yeah, for a show that is supposed to be a sitcom, we are letting the audience know. I mean, obviously, lots of other serious things have happened on the show, but we are, you know, that doesn't happen a lot on sitcoms. You know, the friends never punched each other or anything like that. So it's a great way to end the episode because you're just like, whoa, things are real bad.
I love a good laugh like this.
And it does make me laugh. I love the misery of it.
It is so then we come back from commercial, and in a scene cut in syndication, we see, for me at least, we see Winchester tending to Hawkeye's wound with some, I guess, like some iodine or something on a Q-tip, and Hawkeye's being a big baby. He's like, ah! Like, you know? And of course, Winchester's not helping at all. He says, oh, he was probably aiming for your mouth. You know, it's like doesn't Winchester understand? This is pretty significant that BJ got so loaded he punched Hawkeye. It's like, we're kind of in a new thing here, but Winchester's going to be Winchester.
It hurts my heart that this scene was cut in syndication, Rob. So does the episode like pick back up after the commercial break with Potter and Margaret coming in?
It cuts right to the last line of the scene where they're sitting on the tent and Potter walks in. So it cuts all that stuff out.
Okay, oh, wow. So yeah. Aw, I love that moment with Charles and Hawkeye. Like, just the idea of Charles patching him up so carefully and like so gently while he's still mercilessly making fun of him at the same time. I think it really captures the spirit of their relationship.
Yeah, and it's like the third sort of instance of Charles showing that he actually does kind of care quite a bit in this episode. You know, it's great.
Yeah. So Potter walks in because he's looking for Klinger, and then he's like, what in the name of sweet Fanny Adams, which is another great Potter aphorism. I like that Margaret notices and immediately tends to him. Right? That's like Margaret's a nurse, you know, it's really sweet. And I will say, just in the time between the time we booked this episode to do together and our recording, I went to a wedding, and one of the guests got so drunk they fell over some chairs and passed out. Oh. And he happened to fall, and the chairs were such that like he got his arm caught in one and a leg caught in another. It was a whole thing. And my sister, who is a nurse, immediately ran over to tend to him because she's a nurse, you know? So it's just instinctual to do. Now, he was fine and everything. He didn't hurt himself, but nevertheless, it sounded really bad when he really took a header over these chairs. But it was an Irish wedding. But so
been there.
So, but I mean, I love that the minute Margaret sees that, she, you know, it's such a great detail because he's obviously not hurt that bad. It's just a little scratch over his eye. But I love that she is like, oh, you're hurt. That's a wonderful detail of Margaret to give Margaret. And then, you know, they're like, and then they're like, well, the still finally blow up. And Winchester's in the, Honeycutt did that. And Potter's like, Honeycutt did that? And then I love, you know, I love the line that Hawkeye has where he's like, he got drunk and he got angry and he beat up his two favorite roommates, me and the still. Which is
like, Charles is right there.
But then Winchester goes back with, he's like, well, I admire his, whatever he says, like I admire his judgment or something.
Puzzled by his behavior, but I do admire his judgment.
There you go. So that leads Potter to say, has another great Potter aphorism, has everybody around here gone dingus?
I love that. So good. The power with which he says it is just beautiful.
Has anyone around here gone dingus? So they said that they're looking for Klinger, and they asked Winchester, have you seen him? And he's like, I've neither seen him nor missed him. He's got to throw that in there, of course. So Potter says, okay, well, we're going to split up and look for everybody. Now we've got two people to look for. And right at that point is when Nurse Baker comes in and reminds us all that this is a medical show. And Hawkeye has to go.
Allegedly.
Yeah. Hawkeye has to go attend to the patient. And of course, they're like, okay, well, he's got to go off and do this. And Potter says, you need a hand. And Hawkeye says, the hands I got, it's eyes I'm running out of. So we
There's
briefly.
another, oh, I was just going to say there's another great little background acting moment from Loretta Swit when Potter is pairing up the search parties and he's like, okay, Margaret, you go with Winchester. And Margaret like rolls her eyes so hard because she does not want to be paired up with Charles. Yeah, I just wanted to mention that.
Another great bit cut in syndication is Winchester complaining about having to do this. And they go, oh, come along, Winchester. That's cut. I never saw that until I saw
Aww.
the full episode. But I like that I love that just kind of whine, like he's just whining about it. Like, okay, come on. All right, whatever.
Yeah, like I'll take an order, but I won't be happy and I will complain about it.
So we briefly touch in, check back in with Hawkeye on in post-op where they're talking about the patient. And once again, Nurse Baker gets a lot to do. And he says something about maybe it's this. And she says, I thought of that, Hawk. We did a hematocrit. It's elevated. Now, I have no idea what a hematocrit is. Doctors Ange and Chris, please let us know in the comments what that is. I love Alan Alda's line reading where he goes, very good. Like he's impressed that she thought of that. I think that's great. Again, once again, really a banner episode for Jan Jordan. She gets really a lot of stuff to do. Now, he does have a line though where he orders one ampule of Levifed. And the reason that is significant is because the drug Levifed and its introduction to the unit becomes a major plot in a later episode. They've never had Levifed before until it's mentioned in the episode. I think it's Birthday Girls because it ends up being given to the cow, the pregnant cow. So
Oh,
here,
okay.
Hawkeye just mentions it. So it's just kind of a little bit of a mistake because obviously they're using Levifed pretty regularly here. But later on, it would be a big deal of like, oh, we have Levifed now. We can use Levifed. So there you go. So we then go to Rosie's, and she's closing up for the night, putting chairs up on the table, which is incredibly formal, right? For a place like this, that they put chairs up on the table. Like, do they marry the ketchup bottles too? I don't think. Like, what is this? This isn't a Chili's, it's just a little rundown bar. But okay, whatever. I
This
like
is
that she's.
the finest dining establishment they have, Rob.
I guess so. So then she starts telling Winchester and Hawkeye, excuse me, Winchester and Margaret what happened. And they talk about that BJ and Klinger were together and they're getting drunk and they started harassing some Marines. And she's like, that's bad enough. Until they put up a drawing on the dartboard. They call the game Vaccinate Radar.
Vaccinate radar.
And we cut to the greatest drawing of Gary Berkoff ever cut to
It's
me.
so cute.
I don't want to overstate the case because I'd have to think of other props, but I think if I had to have one prop from MASH, it might be this drawing of because it's crude enough that you believe someone drew it that doesn't know how to draw. And it's also it looks a little like radar, but it's also insulting to him as well. I love it. I absolutely love that drawing. Just,
It's
you
so
know.
iconic. On the DVD menu, when you go to like select period of adjustment, this is the thumbnail still
Oh,
that
that's
comes up
great. Oh,
as the still for this episode. It's so iconic.
whoever did that, by the way, whose ever job it was this to select the stills. They were really on point because there were some great stills in those DVDs. They picked a couple of really it suggests someone that really understood the show and was a maybe even a fan because there were some choices that I think only a fan would make. Like that one. I mean, I don't think most people would think to pick up this horrible drawing of radar. But anyway, vaccinate radar is just and I love that Rosie's, if I may read into it a little, like Rosie's
Please.
offended on Radar's behalf. Like she liked Radar, so I kind of like
Aww.
that's You know, I mean, partly because it's dangerous that they're throwing needles around. It's just, first of all, a flagrant abuse of medical equipment. But I sort of, I don't know, I get the sense that like that's, she's offended on his behalf because she liked him. That's sort of the way I took it.
I like that.
That's
That's nice.
interesting. I like that. Yeah, everyone likes radar.
Yeah, they still pay them. Then she they took the. Then she says we took the needles away, and then they throw. She threw peanuts at Radar face, like she's
Pretzels and peanuts.
pretzels and peanuts at Radar face.
Get them out.
She's so upset, just
That was
absolutely
really good.
fantastic.
I
So,
love Byron Stocky.
oh man. So then we follow Colonel Potter, and we find him, and he goes to the mess tent, and there is Father Mulcahy having a cup of coffee and reading. Maybe Reader's Digest, not the Bible. He reads other things. I mean, it probably is the Bible, actually. I can see there's like gold leaf on the pages. That's got to be a Bible. So that leads to one of the great scenes of this episode for me. Because as I mentioned in the beginning, I love when TV shows reconcile with their own history. I just always find that fascinating. And for a show that has changed as much as MASH did, right? If you look at an episode from season one and you look at this episode, they seem like completely different shows. Both of how they look, tonally, visually, and just every, thematically, they feel like completely different series. So I like that they take the time to pause and point out, yeah, Colonel Potter, you haven't been here since the beginning. And I love the way that Father Mulcahy suckers, I mean, to use that word that Potter uses, he suckers Potter into this because he purposely, he could, if he wanted to not be clever, he could just say, well, Colonel Potter, Radar was inept when he got here, but he doesn't. He tells this story. And it's funny. And if you're a MASH devotee, as all three of us obviously are, for a second, you're like, is there a cat? What? Like, is there another character we haven't heard about? Now, obviously, we know it's a blind, but for a second, you kind of like, huh, what's it? Oh, okay. Oh, I see what he's doing. But I love that. And I also love the detail of when Father Mulcahy mentions Blake and he just pauses and he says, God rest his soul. I that always gets me, as much of a softy that I am. That always gets me that it's a reminder of, yeah, Henry's dead. Henry didn't make it home. And we even see Colonel Potter kind of lowers his head ever so slightly as kind of an acknowledgement of, okay, yeah, my predecessor is not home. And I just think that's a great, I love it. I loved it in the operating scene where Mulcahy tries to chime in and say, hey, everybody, you're all being a little, but this, I love that he thinks about it, conceives it of like, this is how I'm going to tell this story. And this is how I'm going to make my point that you got the broken in model, and now you're judging Klinger by that standard. I just think it's a wonderful scene, and I love that Father Mulcahy gets something so important to do.
He kind of delivers it like it's a parable, doesn't he?
He really does.
Like it's from the Bible. It's great, yeah.
Yeah.
And this scene is also like, I think Molly, you mentioned earlier about like the sort of meta narrative of this episode. I think this scene brings that up again, like mentioning Henry Blake and comparing, replacing him with Potter to replacing Radar with Klinger. It really feels like to me that they were anticipating more angry letters from people after Radar left, just like when Henry died. And they're like trying to get across this message to us of, don't worry, it's a big change and it's okay to be sad. But, like you said, we've allowed the show to grow and change quite a bit since the end of season three. And, look at us all now. You've got Potter. You love Potter. Everything's going to be okay. Give it a chance. Give it some time, to adjust to it, I don't know if that's what they were actually thinking when they plotted this out, like if they did it on purpose, but it's interesting that they included a scene that very pointedly sort of like warns us away from the attitude of this new change in my TV show is bad.
There probably
Yeah,
had
I
to be
think.
some level of meta narrative threaded in here because this was a very, very popular show and it was making a big change. So I think there's probably something to that.
Yeah, I think it's also a great dynamic between Mulcahy and Potter in the scene where even though Potter outranks him, militarily speaking, Mulcahy is the one who's kind of coming from a position of more experience and more wisdom in this case because he's been there longer. So I like that they kind of allow that sort of power dynamic to be present in the scene.
Yeah. It's a reminder that, yeah, Father Mulcahy was here, has been here since the beginning, and Colonel Potter has not. And he remembers that time of the unit. I just, again, I that's that, as you talk about, you guys keep saying catnip. This is catnip for me, is when they talk about when they talk about old episodes, not that long ago, they did almost by the time people hear this episode, it'll almost be a year. But like when they did that Saturday Night Live 50th anniversary, there were a bunch of sketches about the show itself. And like, those are always like, oh, I just love that. I love when like older cast members are talking about newer ones, or newer ones are talking about older. I find that stuff so fascinating. Again, I don't know why. But so this episode is all of that, of like, hey,
it has it all.
It has it all, right? So Colonel Potter sort
Except
of says,
Frank. No one cares about Frank.
No one cares about Frank. Yes. Well, we will get to that in the time capsule episode.
It takes them almost until the end of the show to be like, by the way, remember when Frank was here too?
getting in one last dig at that guy right at the 5 yard line of the show. Yeah,
there is some stuff that happens sooner, I think, like with Margaret.
Yes.
But we don't need to get into that right now.
Right. Yeah, no, I like I said, I love all that stuff. So, and Colonel Potter says, you know, basically, well, I'll try. And he has another great Potter aphorism. He's like, it's hard to be patient with someone who can't find a hippo in a footlocker, you know, all that kind of stuff. So, okay. So Winchester and Margaret show up and say, we know they're together. But we don't know where they are. And they're like, well, let's call the MP. And then Winchester says, I'm officially resigning from the search party. So of course, cause he's not interested in any of this. So
it's crazy to me. Sorry. It's crazy to me that there's like this whole extra unseen sequence in this episode where at some point Klinger and BJ have crossed paths. And they were like, hey, we're like experiencing like variations on a theme. Do you want to like team up and go get drunk? And they have this angry little pub crawl that we don't even get to see. They're such an interesting duo. I'm kind of sad that we didn't get to see more of them together.
I like the idea of a pub crawl. It's one pub, but they got the one pub crawl.
A very angry, spiteful little pub crawl.
BJ better hope that wounded aren't arriving anytime soon, right? Because my man is not ready to operate. So then we find them in Potter's office, and they are, of course, completely pie-eyed. BJ almost severs his wrist tendon by shoving his hand through the glass of Potter's.
That whole
liquor.
Bit is so funny, the buildup of getting the keys and how they're moving so like slow and sloppily. BJ looks like his entire body is made of string cheese. He cannot move properly at all. And it takes so long for this bit of getting the key and bringing it over. Are you sure this is the right one? And then just slamming his hand through the glass. It's like a Zucker Brothers bit. It's so funny. I love that gag so much.
I also love when the scene cuts to them in the office, the portrait of Radar is hanging on the wall directly like above their heads behind them, like they're being haunted by
Oh
the
my God,
of
I didn't even think of that. Oh yeah. Oh, that's great. That's really funny. So yeah, they're making noise. So then Potter and Margaret show up. There's a line about where Potter's like, I don't know how to make a phone call, and Margaret's like, I'll give it a try, which I mean, I understand we all can't know everything, but maybe an appreciation of Klinger, because you're just admitting none of you know how to make a damn phone call. Mm-hmm. You would think the commander would know how to use the phone, right? You would think that would be pretty basic stuff, but okay. So, we're not really appreciating yes, Klinger's not great at this job, but we're not even appreciating what he can do, because he knows how to make a phone call at least. So they hear some Yahoo stuff and they figure out, okay, so they go in the office and BJ is up on the saddle stirrup
where
thing.
He usually is, of course.
Yes, right. Very up there. And he's wearing Colonel Potter's hat. Incredibly disrespectful. Klinger has got this sort of bucket or something. I guess it's a planter, because there's like a plant design on it. I'm guessing he's holding onto it because he think he might throw up or something. Mm-hmm. I guess that's the idea of that. And they are, they are soused. I've mentioned in previous episodes, I thought Loretta Swit was, of all the actors, the best at playing drunk. I just love the way she did it. It, to me, was the most plausible. I think Mike Farrell, Jimmy Farr, maybe overdoing it just a touch, but it's okay. It's fine. They're meant to be, they're silly drunk.
They're meant to be completely like drunk as we've never seen them before.
Yeah. Yeah. they're very, very silly drunk. And so, you know, it's fine. So Potter says to Klinger, I want to talk to you outside. And I love, he's like, you know, Klinger says, don't, BJ says to Potter, don't hit him in the, don't hit him in the nose. He's got a schnootful, which is a great.
There's another amazing line in this scene that we have to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
Argyle Sotts. Can we talk about Argyle Sotts? First of all, I love that BJ is still able to make puns in this state. It's like it's the last thing that'll ever leave him, you know, that ability to make these stupid jokes. But, and second of all, as mentioned again on a previous MASHcast episode with Molly, BJ has a thing about his Argyle socks that he has with him in Korea that remind him of home. Season 4, episode 19.
He never wears, right.
He doesn't wear them. He just washes them over and over. And that way they always stay clean. Obviously, because he's crazy, projecting this fear about home changing without him and himself changing while he's away from home onto a pair of Argyle socks. So how interesting. What a coincidence that in Period of Adjustment, the ultimate BJ breakdown about life back home episode, he somehow manages to bring up Argyle socks again. It's a very interesting joke, BJ. Very interesting.
You've got him on the couch, right? And you're sitting there with your clipboard and your...
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting joke, Mr. Dr. Honeycutt. That's interesting. Okay.
Tell me more. Tell me more about these socks.
Yeah. Oh, our hour is up. I'm sorry. So so the Potter drags Klinger out into this chair. He's holding on to this pot thing for really no good reason. And that leads to, we see BJ trying to slowly sink himself off of the horse. What's the name of that thing?
Saddle.
No, but it's like there's a Charlie. I think it's like a Charlie horse.
The
no,
thing
not.
That it stands on. I
I'm blanking what the term for that is. Sawhorse. Sawhorse.
Yeah.
Thank you. If there's ever a purgatory, it will be me with just a phone with podcasts full of people that can't remember a thing, and I'm yelling at the phone. So Sawhorse, everybody. Sawhorse. If that bit had gone longer, I would have edited it out. So anyway. Klinger sits down, and it leads to the second great conversation on the show about the history. And Potter jumps right to it, where he says, he says, radar is no Klinger. And radar, he's like, so they tell me, sir. And he's like, folks around here were awfully fond of Henry Blake when he ran this post. And I love Klinger's response. Sure. The colonel was a top-notch kind of a guy. Mm. And it's delivered very comedically because he's drunk. But I love the way he says that. I just love.
Also very sincerely, though.
Yes. Mm. Yes. The love he has for Colonel Blake is evident in the way Jamie Farr delivers that. He was colonel was a top-notch kind of a guy. And Potter's like, you bet he was. And then we get into this wonderful little insight into Potter's mindset at the time, something they never addressed because they were busy doing other things. But the idea that he's like, people were a little unsure about me when I got here. Nobody was jumping for joy over me. I was no Henry Blake, and I never tried to be. It didn't mean I was better or worse, just different. But people gave me a chance to get comfortable and make this job Sherman Potter's. And that is something I forgot when you took over for radar. And it's like, I want to just jump into this pool neck deep. I want to talk to Potter endlessly about this. Cause I love that it's something that's referring to a long ago season, but it doesn't rewrite anything. Mm. It's like, oh, that's just an insecurity that Potter had that we never heard about, that he was feeling very strange about taking over for Henry Blake. And again, much like we had with Father Mulcahy, Klinger remembers that time because he was on the show back then. And so I dine out on that stuff of him asking Klinger, yeah, Henry Blake was pretty good, wasn't he? And Klinger's like, he's a top-notch kind of a guy. This whole exchange is so good.
Mm.
Yeah, I love that again, they're like giving Potter the chance to kind of speak directly to the audience in that meta sense of like, yeah, you guys weren't jumping for joy when I joined the show, but like, guess what? Now you love me. So yeah, it's going to be okay. Change is okay, guys.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've ever heard this story. You probably have because you're obsessive about it like I am. But apparently, right after Mike Farrell joined the show, I think it was Alan Alda that took him aside and said, the show is going to take a bit of a hit in the ratings because you're new. And some people aren't going to like that. It's not your fault. It has nothing to do with you. It's the audience. They'll come back. And of course they did. And then apparently Mike Farrell then gave that exact speech to David Ogden Stiers when he joined the show. And I love that. I love that they had enough presence of mind to sit the guy down and say, don't worry. It's all fine. Like, it's not on you. It's good. And so I love that. It's getting back to that whole meta thing that you two of you have been talking about, that they are talking to the audience in some respect about this. Like, it's okay. It's a big change. It'll be fine.
I can't imagine Charles showing up to replace Frank and not being like overjoyed. That seems crazy to me. Charles showing up, it's like when Charles arrives, it's like the show becomes the beautiful final form, like fully evolved Pokemon version of itself. It's the best thing ever. I can't imagine being like, I don't want to watch this anymore. Frank's gone. Like, are you kidding me?
I mean, there was that thing about Felicity that people stopped watching the show after she got a haircut. So people are weird. People are weird.
People are fickle like that.
People are fickle like that. So so they clear the air and Potter says, Raider's office is closed. Klinger's is open. And then Klinger passes out and Potter's like, fine, we'll open tomorrow. So then Hawkeye shows up with his army helmet, which is a great little visual gag. I love the way he wears it, too. He kind of wears it comedically. He puts it down further over his eyes than he normally would be. It's very Abbott and Costello kind of thing. And Potter says, mine's here, yours is in there. Hawkeye opens the door almost the way you would in a horror movie, right? The kind of like, is the killer in here? That kind of a little bit of that. BJ sees him and laughs hysterically, and he says, you wear your soldier hat, which he just finds so funny. And then after he breaks down, he says, you know what I did today? I hit the best friend I ever had. And that's just a beautiful, the way, and he says, I'm sorry, Hawk, I'm sorry. The way he delivers it, all this stuff is, this is just great, great stuff.
It's very, this whole scene is very confronting. To watch this character who usually tries very hard to hide anger and sadness, to see him like all his defenses are like just gone and all these really hard truths just keep spilling out of his mustache. It's hard to watch. It's very vulnerable, and I find it kind of uncomfortable. Like, I want to look away. It's a lot.
I like when he's talking, BJ is talking, and at one point while he's talking, he uncorks the bottle and it makes that great sound. And if you watch it, you see that Hawkeye, with his eyes, follows that, right?
Yeah, he tracks the bottle.
He tracks the bottle going up to BJ's mouth and back again. And obviously,
it looks like he wants to say something, but decides it is not the time.
Exactly. Now, obviously, they would continue to drink on the show. I mean, at the end of the episode, they get the still back. But I feel like the show, I feel like the show dialed it down in later seasons. I think they realized, okay, you know, it was funny in the early, we're getting a little maybe old for this. And it just looks, maybe we shouldn't be pushing that so hard after something like this. When we see that, because obviously some people, when they get drunk, they're silly drunk. And that's me. I get clumsy and stupid. But like, you know, I fell out of a boat once, you know. So, yeah.
Rob, did you fall? Was your cousin there?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He pushed me. So I'm not ready to. Molly, I'm not ready to get into that just yet.
Don't smell the mold. Don't go towards the mold.
I'm feeling so itchy all of a sudden. I don't understand. So So, but anyway, I get silly drunk, but some people get angry drunk. And BJ obviously gets angry drunk when he's drunk like this. So, okay. But yeah, I love that bit of Alan Alda's that he doesn't. Again, I keep giving them compliments for not overdoing it, but that just means they're good actors because you don't want to overdo it. But I just like that his head just ever so slightly watches BJ uncork the bottle, bring it up to his lips, and then put it back down. It's just the kind of like, okay, maybe we should stop with this, you know. I think that's absolutely great. So then the camera zooms in on BJ telling the story, and he talks about, you know, the first time my little girl ever called anybody daddy, and it wasn't me. And Hawkeye says, you know, it could have been anybody in a uniform. And BJ's like,
Which
I
is
know.
the worst thing he could have said, and he's
Terrible.
trying to be helpful,
Oh
but
no.
that's the thing BJ's sensitive about.
See
The
now,
idea
okay.
that, like, oh yeah, like anyone could have replaced you.
Oh, see, that's funny. Now, I never took it that way. I actually thought that was a nice thing to say because he is saying it's not radar. It's just he's sort of reminding BJ that she's an infant. She barely has object permanence yet, you know? Like, that's funny that you took that as a bad thing to say because I always thought it was kind of a nice thing to say.
I think that's how BJ takes it. I understand that Hawkeye is trying to say a nice thing, and I do
Yeah.
think that, you know, it was probably the best thing that came to his mind. But like for BJ personally, I think that's the thing that he's so sensitive about, this idea that like, oh, like I'm like any man off the street could just like come in and replace me, essentially.
Okay.
Yeah, it's and I think it's really compelling how like these two have such a close bond. They live together, they work together, they finish each other's sentences, but they never really understand on a fundamental level what the other one is most afraid of. And I think this goes with BJ for Hawkeye as well. I think that's something that carries through all the way to Goodbye, Farewell, and Amen. And there's a huge, like, their whole argument over why BJ doesn't want to say goodbye is a huge example of them just completely misunderstanding what the other one
Totally.
is afraid of, or like what is going to hurt the other one the most. And yeah, it's just once I'm always amazed by how MASH kind of played very fast and loose with continuity whenever they felt like it, but at the same time, the emotional continuity of Hawkeye and BJ's relationship is so consistent across 8 years.
It's crazy.
That's fascinating. That's really interesting. I agree with you. There was clearly the runner through multiple seasons that Hawkeye is deeply hurt at friends that don't leave notes, like the friends that just leave. So that's a runner all literally till the last episode. They were still pressing that bruise a little bit. But that's really interesting because I said I always took it as that I thought that's a good point of because it could almost be like, you know, it's like a little kid who sees like a dog and it's like, oh, all dogs are dog. Well, you know what I mean? Like, well, yeah, all animals are dogs. No. You know, just because it walks on four legs doesn't mean it's, you know, it's like it's a little, she's like a year old, you know, like, you know, whatever. But okay.
It's I'm
That's
not
the
saying it's rational. That's just how BJ
Sure.
feels. There's another bit here that I think is an example of the way things like the sort of emotional continuity being really strong. There's a part in this little BJ speech where he talks about I'm jumping ahead just a tiny bit, but he's missed so much of Aaron's life. And he says, even if I go home tomorrow, I'll never get that back. Which is, that's to me, that really stands out because it's like he's admitting at this point that he already understands on some level that going home is not going to fix the problem of having been away. Because, you know, we can never go home, of course. Going home is a fake idea and a total fantasy. And the place you know is home will have changed and you will have changed. You can hold on to the idea of going home as long as you're away, but it's not as real or inevitable as we would like to think. And that is a lesson that BJ learns over and over and over again, right up until the finale. He's still learning that. And then randomly at the start of season eight, still with years of the show to come, he straight up just says, I know it's not actually possible for things to be the same. It's this huge, like, scary thing for him to admit. And I think it makes perfect, like, emotional sense that then in the cold, sober light of day, that he'll have just buried it again. And the next time he's faced with something that challenges his idea of going home unchanged, it'll be like the first time all over again. Like he's never even learned this lesson right up until Goodbye, Farewell, Amen. It happens over and over and over again. It's amazing.
Yeah, he can only confront it like when he's got to this point where he's just like so broken down and in so much
Exactly.
despair right now that
Yeah.
he can actually look halfway honestly at himself and be like, yeah, I've changed and like this has affected me and my relationship with my family, and even if I go home tomorrow, it's not going to magically fix that.
Yeah. For once, the boy is not lying. Incredible.
Rob, have you read the book Giovanni's Room?
I'm so glad you caught that.
I feel like I'm getting lured into a metaphorical van here, but okay, no, I have not.
Giovanni's Room by James Baldwin was a book written in the 50s, not too long after the time when MASH takes place. I think it was like 57, something like that. But it's basically about this young man who, journeys away to Europe. He's like young man kind of leaving home for the first time. He's engaged and he goes overseas and he starts having an affair with this man that he meets when he's in Paris. And the whole time, the protagonist kind of has this idea that like, oh, like this is just an affair. It doesn't mean anything. I'm going to go home and like that'll be the end of it. And there's a scene where Giovanni, the character he's having an affair with, is like, oh, well, as long as you're here, you can think that. As long as you're here and home is, this abstract concept, you can always think to yourself, one day I'll go home. Then you're going to go home and you're going to find that home is not home anymore. And then you'll really be in trouble. Which I think is just such a perfect parallel for what is happening with BJ. So I definitely would recommend that book for some, extra credit reading.
Yeah, foundational BJ Honeycutt texts. Absolutely.
I mean, there's the line in the culture, you can't go home again, which, if when you, I think when you're first introduced to it, maybe if, depending on what age you are, but when you're first introduced to it, it sounds like that, well, home is not the thing you thought it was, so therefore you can't go home again. But it can mean, no, it's you. It's you're different. You the person who is coming back is not the same. You're not the same person he was when he left. So therefore, you can't really go home again because it's not the same experience, you know? So, but yeah, I think that's a great line where he's saying, like, even if I go home tomorrow, I'll never get that back. And you're like, that's what my service has taken from me is so offensive on such a molecular level. And so the camera, Charles S. Dubin slowly just zooms in here on Mike Farrell as he's still doing the speech. And then he talks about, I can see that, stroking her hair, about Peg and the perfume she wears. And then he says, getting the hug I should have gotten. And then he says, Radar's home hawk, I should be glad for him. And then he goes, but I'm not. And Mike Farrell, I think, shreds the audio a little bit on this. You can almost hear a slight
The clip.
distortion. And I have to think whoever was recording the, when they went back and played the tape, they were like, ooh, because like it probably bumped up to the thing. But I can't imagine Mike Farrell did this multiple times. I hope not for his sake that he got in one, because this is so brutal that I like, hopefully, he didn't have to put himself through this multiple times. But yeah, you can, it's, there's an audio fry that you very rarely hear on a broadcast network television show. But I think they were like, the rawness of the performance is so good that they did what they could. And he says, I'm so filled with envy. I'm torn up with envy.
Torn up with envy.
I almost hate him, which is understandable. And then he throws in a real surprise. And I feel the same way about Trapper. And I've never even met him. And for devotees of MASH, you're like, what? Oh,
I
huh?
would love your thoughts
What
on
are you
Trapper being
talking
brought up
about?
here. Like this, it genuinely, when you watch it, it feels like a plot twist. It's a huge reveal, totally out of nowhere. Rob, I would love to know what you think about Trapper being brought up here.
I mean,
Yeah,
is
Rob,
well, I
why do
mean,
you think?
is BJ jealous of every single person that's ever gone home? I mean, you can't be jealous of Trapper that you've never met it. I mean, I understand that he knows he's filling Trapper's place. So I get that. And much like the thing with Colonel Potter, where we're finding out that Colonel Potter felt a little insecure about taking over for Henry Blake, and that's something that we'd never learned. We're finding out that it wasn't easy for BJ either, apparently, when he got there. he was probably hearing about, oh, Trapper was funny. And we obviously, the Joker is Wild episode in season 11, we'll lean into this really heavily, that this is something that's a sore point for BJ. And the idea that, like, your buddy went home and you know, he's home too. It's like, wow, there's some festering stuff going on with these guys.
Especially
been simmering in the volcano this whole time. And when everything else comes exploding out, this gets dragged up with it too. I don't think it's just about the fact that Trapper got to go home, but Phoebe, what was your thought?
Especially in the way that, okay, because what he says is not just Trapper got to go home. He says, and he built that still with you, and he got to go home. That for me is like a second plot twist. It feels like it's recontextualizing the smashing of the still, because it's like, wait, pause. Is that why you smashed it up? Was a little part of BJ's brain thinking about Trapper when he did it? Because again, no one brought up Trapper or the still. That came entirely from within BJ's own head. It has nothing to do with Aaron and Radar or Peg. And he says to Hawkeye, he built that still with you. So it's like there's this crazy idea sort of floating through the static here about how BJ isn't just jealous that Trapper got to go home like Radar, but specifically jealous of what Trapper and Hawkeye shared together in Korea before BJ got there, and how Trapper had that and then also got to return home to his family like Radar did.
Is it like someone that marries somebody and they move into the house? Is that what it is? You know, it's like
it could be some of that.
We don't go get a new house together. I'm living in, it's Rebecca, you know, it's like, I'm living in, yes, I have to live in the tent. I have to literally sleep in the cot that this guy slept in, but I've also been using this
right there.
Still is exactly right there. So yeah.
So BJ makes this association between Radar and Trapper for, you know, some reason. He says that he's torn up with envy because Radar had a special moment with Aaron that BJ feels should have been his moment. And then he immediately follows that up with, he feels the same way about Trapper, presumably for a long time now. Mm-hmm. And as Phoebe said, follows that with, Trapper built the still with Hawkeye. That was their special thing that BJ feels jealous of. Mm. And just like he's insecure about his role as Aaron's father, he's insecure about his role in Hawkeye's life. Just like Aaron could have seen any man in a uniform and called him daddy, Hawkeye could have rebounded from Trapper with any other randomly assigned bunkmate, or so BJ thinks anyway.
Wow.
And
we gotta get into this Trapper complex. This is why BJ is
emotionally lumping these things together is another question entirely. I don't think he knows why he's associating these things together. Mm. To me, it suggests that Aaron and Hawkeye have equally important places in his heart, is what that says to me.
Wow.
And when he's in this drunk, overly emotional state that he's in, he's conflating those two people in his life. So just food for thought there.
I honestly, you know that a big part of Mash Blur is like watching the show with one eye on like the actual quote unquote actual canonical events of it, and then another eye on the version that exists in our minds where everybody's gay, right? And I imagine you're us and you're watching this show with that lens on it, and then this episode happens where BJ like brings up Trapper in this moment and then like breaks the still in with a chair in a drunken rage. When I saw this, I felt like the heavens had opened up and like this holy gay light was shining down upon me, because that is exactly what I would expect to happen in the gay version of the show that I've been watching in my mind, except they did it for real in the real version on TV
with like 30 million crazy people watching.
Exactly. It's insane.
I mean, the still.
Yeah, it's like that. It's like that. We have to get rid of like everything that used to be your exes, because like, I don't want to look at it.
I mean,
but they did it for real.
Yeah, I mean,
when BJ and Hawkeye literally meet when Hawkeye has just finished chasing after Trapper to the airport, like it's a cheesy rom-com. That's when they meet. Like, this has been festering since the beginning.
I mean, the still is the closest that Hawkeye and Trapper had to having a baby together, right? Is the still. And now BJ's raising this new baby, if I want to go further down into this madness.
Mm-hmm.
But there
mm-hmm.
it is, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's very interesting. Now, it's very funny that we happen to be talking about this, because I was up last night scrolling through my phone, and I happened to come across this old GIF, it was like a reel on Instagram that I've seen before, but I just, if for some reason, someone posted it again and I happened to see it. I don't know if the two of you have ever watched any of the Bob Newhart TV shows, the one from the 70s and then the one in the 80s. In the 70s, he was a psychiatrist, and in the 80s, he was played a different character. He ran it in, and he had two different actresses playing different characters. He was a completely different character in both shows. So in the 70s show, the actress was Suzanne Pleshette playing a character called Emily. And then in the Newhart show, in the 80s show, the actress was named Mary Fran, and blanking on what her character's name was, but it's not Emily. There was a meme going around of an episode of Newhart, the second show, where Bob Newhart is playing the scene with Mary Fran, and he slips and refers to her as Emily, his first wife from the old show. And Mary Fran immediately picks up on it and like throws her arms up, and the audience hears it, and it just becomes this massive laugh because Bob Newhart has realized he's just called his new TV wife by his old TV wife's name. And it's very funny to me that we're watching the scene together while I just saw that meme again, because there it is. It's like, oh yeah, you're still, Emily is still on your mind, Bob? Like, what is that about? So there it is. It's for people who don't know about Mash Blur or only visit it occasionally like I do, the idea of seeing Mash through that lens is a little like, what? But then when you see scenes like this, you go, well, I get, all right, there it is.
Okay, yes.
There it is.
Welcome to the dark side.
Yeah, there it is.
You can't prove it didn't happen.
Right. And in a great, and again, in a meta sense, in terms of masculinity on television, I have grown up, I grew up in the 70s and 80s because I'm ancient. I grew up and virtually every man on TV was presented as a idiot horn dog. Virtually. All men were like that. And I never responded to that as a young person and as a teenager. The reason MASH became MASH to me is because MASH was different. MASH presented men with a sensitive side that I knew that I had, that I was always a little ashamed to reveal. And here was these guys doing it. And so even within that broader context, men could cry on TV occasionally, but it would have to be at the very most like a single tear, right? Coming out of the side of your, not a blubbering make that just fall apart. That is never, men do not do that. They don't do it now on television. Right?
While another
man cradles your head. That is not done. And the fact that Mike Farrell and the show was comfortable in presenting that is pretty, that was not nothing to young 7-year-old me when this episode aired, to be that this show would show one of my heroes, BJ Honeycutt, as this emotionally destroyed. That was a big deal. That was a big deal. And watching it over again, it's like, yeah, this is pretty gutsy that they would present that. And I have always been very envious in a lot of ways of, like, my wife is very demonstrative with her physicality. She hugs, she's a hugger. She hugs a little bit. She has gone to hugging my family before I did. And I noticed that women tend to be like that. Not all men are this way or whatever, but for the most part. And I've always been envious of that women are more comfortable with that side of who they are, and men have to just start, no, you know. And so here's the show doing this in front of, like I just said, 30 million people at this point when the show was watching it. And it's a beautiful scene. And again, I love the physicality that he puts his hand over BJ's forehead. Yeah. Like he's almost checking his temperature, you know, like a kid, like a parent would. Are you warm?
Yeah.
How you doing? You know? So the scene is, it's really beautiful. It's tough to watch. But you know, Hawkeye tries his best. We'll go home. One day we'll all go home. And, you know, that doesn't really mollify BJ a whole lot because of the lines you just talked about, you know, the whole, I could go home tomorrow and I'll never get that back. And it seemed, the scene ends in a dark way. Yeah. It doesn't end with any really resolution. It's like, nah, we're all just dealing with a lot of pain. Okay, let's hear from Ray Cerrone now. You know, it's tough.
I love that you brought that up, Rob, the idea that like nothing really gets resolved at the end, but it's the scene still feels cathartic. Like even though just the fact that like BJ has been able to voice this, like even though there's maybe nothing they can do about it, it's still like just him being able to get that out. And I do think it's really beautiful that it ends on just this simple gesture of physical comfort when that kind of steps in when words are failing them. If we have just a little bit more time to spend on that idea of time and like the missed time that BJ has, which I think Phoebe, you probably know where I'm going to go with this. But the idea of battling with time is something we see in this scene. And it's another motif that we see like throughout the show for BJ and Hawkeye in particular. It happens both literally that we see them battling against time in like in scenarios with patients, like in the episode Lifetime, Death Takes a Holiday is another one where it's like they're very literally fighting against the clock. It also happens figuratively, like for example, when Hawkeye writes to Erin in his will and he's trying to explain to her why BJ missed out on that time with her, again, it's like he's trying to give time back to BJ when that's not possible, but it's he's trying to do it in any way he can. And then, of course, it also features very strongly in GFA, this idea that, like, BJ is fighting time and it's, like, trying, you know, to get back before Erin's birthday and, like, that whole thing. So with that recurring theme in mind, it's interesting. If we go back to the scene where BJ smashes the still, he said, as he's doing it, he says, just trying not to waste any more time. So on one level, in that scene, he's responding to the comment Hawkeye just made about how, oh, it'll get you drunk, but it won't get you home. And that is kind of what triggers BJ to smash the still in the first place. But like Phoebe brought up, now that we have the context of knowing that BJ sees the still as being symbolic of Hawkeye and Trapper's relationship, as BJ has just revealed to us in this scene, what time does BJ feel like he's wasted? What time is he trying to like make up for? And so it's, you know, there's different ways to interpret this. What I think is that BJ is at a point where he can't imagine his life without Hawkeye in it. And he's at the point, to the point where he retroactively wishes he had known Hawkeye sooner. I think that relationship is something that completes him in a way he didn't know he was missing until he found it. And I think that, yes, he resents Trapper for having been there first and having met Hawkeye first. Again, not saying that that is rational, just how I interpret BJ's state of mind. Steve, do you got anything to bounce off of that?
That's so true. Everything you just said is so true. And I think,
thank you.
you know, I think you're a total genius, of course. I think, yeah, it's all of that combined with the fact that Trapper got to sort of indulge in that relationship that they had, and then also got to go home to his wife and his daughters, presumably completely scot-free. Like, we haven't heard from him since. Apparently everything's fine, you know, and that's also something he's jealous of. Yeah.
That Trapper got to have a clean break. He got to go home, and it's like, he doesn't write, you know, he doesn't, as far as BJ thinks, it's like Trapper doesn't even think about Hawkeye anymore. Mm-hmm. Like, how is that even possible? You know, like,
oh, BJ, I thought about that. I'm like, did Hawkeye home. Never called him? Right? He never, Never, you know, he never. Can I call, make a call to Boston? Yeah, it's like Trapper never existed. Yeah, totally.
Yeah, I think BJ cannot fathom that happening with him and Hawkeye. From BJ's point of view, I think that maybe he's afraid that Hawkeye will forget about him, and like knowing that he is never going to be able to let go of that relationship.
Scary.
But yeah, but it happened with Trapper, and BJ thinks that that's crazy.
Wow. Whew. So, okay.
What
Welcome
else
to
can you
hour
say
three,
but
everybody,
wow?
of this episode. So, I love the show. People don't like ambiguity in their entertainment, especially Americans, I think, really don't like ambiguity. And so I credit MASH for having episodes where you're like, we can't solve this in 24 minutes. It's just the way it reminds me of the Hawk's Nightmare episode where we find out Hawkeye's having nightmares because he's dealing with inner torment. And Sydney's like, yeah, you got it. Not much we can do about it. You know, wow. Okay. Let's run the credits, I guess. So that's here. Yeah. BJ is just suffering. And there's Hawkeye just kind of looks around the room because it's what's there to be done, right? What's there to be done about it? So that's the end of the episode and or the end of the main episode. And then we come back and we see that the still has been rebuilt. Not much subtext there. And
Listen, listen.
the still has been rebuilt. Klinger is helping out. He's got these goggles on, which he's never had on before, which I really love. It makes him look like the Invisible Man from the 1930s.
Great
So
one.
they talk about this. They see that it's got new parts and it's all kind of chromey and shiny and stuff like that. BJ mentions a neighbor that he had, Elmer Einstein, who would have loved this thing.
He doesn't
Then that guy
exist. That
doesn't
guy is
exist.
not, yeah, not real.
That guy, you made that guy up. Boy's a liar. He's a liar.
There's,
Like Gerald Rasmussen. He didn't exist.
Yep, not real.
they used to do that joke on 30 Rock where Tracy Jordan would mention somebody, Little and Brown, where he would say that's the agency that represents midget black people. And Liz Lemon goes, Dad, you made that up. That person doesn't exist.
That's how I feel every time BJ mentions someone.
There you
Yeah,
go.
not
So,
real.
by the way, we see in the pan down, we see that we see the back of the set. Because the tent has been pulled away, but again, we see the sound stage a little bit, which is fine. It happens sometimes. And then they take a first three glasses, and I love that they do a tribute to Klinger where they compliment him in honor of your astounding resourcefulness, imagination, and downright dishonesty. And I love that Klinger's like, yeah, he's nodding his
So
head. Really,
proud.
it's a button to, I lost them. It's the same. He's so proud of that. And they give him the honor of the first belt. Klinger takes a sip. And of course, it probably tastes like gasoline or something. He spits it out. And, Hawkeye says, how about that beige? There's another beige. How about that beige? We were afraid it wouldn't be good. And BJ says, here's mud in your eye. Hawkeye says, beats knuckles any day. They clink glasses. And finally, we're at the end of a period of adjustment.
And one more thing about this button scene is that Hawkeye refers to the batch from the new still as their firstborn. Like literally what we were
Oh,
talking about
wow.
earlier.
Literally, after
And
everything.
the subtext
Oh.
of them, it's actually text here. Like, that's a very interesting joke, Hawkeye. Why don't you tell us more about how you secretly want to have a family with BJ?
Even the fact that like we've already established obviously that the still is the original still is representative of Hawkeye and Trapper's relationship. So in this scene when Hawkeye says to BJ, this isn't just a collection of hardware. This still has soul and warmth and love. What's going on there?
The
What's different
secret
about this
ingredient
still
is love.
that they've made? This is the Hawk Beach still now. This is the new still, and it's made with soul and warmth and love. Oh, interesting.
You know,
And here's our firstborn.
one could argue that everybody on MASH Blair is reading too much into the show, but then it's like, yeah, but you, hey, MASH, stop doing stuff like this then, and they won't be reading into it. I mean,
Exactly.
there it is.
Exactly. We
So,
wouldn't be reading into it if they didn't put this stuff in there in the first place.
there you go. So, yeah.
Exactly.
So that's the end of our episode. We need to credit the writers. I mentioned them at the top of the show about 4 hours ago. That's Jim Mulligan and Jim Rappaport. This is their first episode of both writers, which is wow. Talk about hitting the ground running.
They knew something.
they were on the 70s version of Tumblr, and they were like, we're gonna really load this up.
Blast their socks off with this one.
It's interesting because Period of Adjustment is a bottle episode, and that there's no guest stars, there's no new sets. They don't leave the, you know, other than going to Rosie's, we just see the same four or five buildings that we always see. So you could see why you might hand this one to new writers, because it's a little less of a, you know, form breaking. At the same time, this is a heavy one to hand your new writers, right? Mm-hmm. This one, like, hey, write the one that's going to deal with the character, a beloved character leaving. This was the first of four MASHes that Jim Mulligan would write. He would work on shows like Trapper John. Oh, subtext there. Silver Spoons, What's Happening. He wrote a bunch of Perry Como specials, and he also worked on a show called Szyznik, spelled S-Z-Y-S-Z-N-Y-K, which was a sitcom starring Ned Beatty, which I guess it was sort of like the network was sort of daring the audience to follow a show that they couldn't pronounce. And the audience said, America said, no, thank you. And after 15 episodes, it got canceled. Jim Rappaport would go on to work on the show all the way through Goodbye, Farewell, and Amen. So he actually had much more of a longer run with the show than Jim Mulligan did. This was the first of 11 MASHes he wrote for, as well as MASH on the Family, The Odd Couple, Maude. And then his last credit, he has no credits past 1984, which is, as far as I know, he is still around. So that's interesting to me that you can work on the most popular show on television and basically not work again. His last credit is a TV movie called Second Edition, the star of which is G.W. Bailey. So just a little bit of a MASH connection there. But anyway, they crushed this one. I mean, they hit the ball out of the park. They hit the ball went into the parking lot. They hit this one so hard. This is a classic episode. I'd say one of the 20 great MASH episodes they ever did. So it's just a classic, and I'm glad we spent 6 hours talking about it, you two.
Well, the time
could
flew
not
by.
Be more glad.
let's do you each have a favorite line? Molly, we'll start with you. Do you have a favorite line or joke from this episode?
So many of them. What I'm going to go with though is BJ's "You wore your soldier hat" line. And yes, on one level, it's a joke. Obviously, BJ thinks it's hilarious when he says it. But just the fact of him referring to, sorry, my cat is, all right. Sorry if the microphone was picking up some vibrations just now. The fact that BJ refers to the helmet as a soldier hat is just such like a very distinct Beach thing that he does when he'll refer to the scrubs as like their doctor clothes, and like referring to like articles of clothing as like being designated under like certain roles, and this idea that like you put this hat on and like now you're a soldier, or like now you're a doctor, or now you're whatever, is just very interesting to me. I think BJ kind of has a looser relationship with identity than Hawkeye does, for sure. So it's just like a little interesting thing to me, that's how he refers to it, and it also is just a funny line.
I love sneaking in one more like Beach introspective moment just under the wire there. Very good job, Molly.
Phoebe, what about you?
Oh my god, it's really hard to pick. I do really love when BJ smashes the glass in Potter's office. I also love the very first lines that Potter says in this episode when he talks about bulletins flying in every direction and officers blowing up in your face. But this is a sad episode. This is a tragic episode. So I have to, I kind of want to just say the entire fight in the swamp, basically. That entire scene is so good. But there's also, okay, if I have to pick one moment from it, there's a bit where right after BJ says, tell me how much you miss your kid, the reaction shot of Hawkeye, the face that he makes, that I feel like they hold on it for like 5 seconds in total silence. It just, it breaks my heart. I love his little face in that moment. It's so good.
he's like, I've had enough. I'm letting him vent. Okay. Time to reel this in a little bit.
It's all on Alan Alda's face.
Yeah. For me, this is for how much of a heavy episode this is. There were a lot of jokes. There's a lot of really funny jokes. I always know it's a particularly funny episode when I'm watching it, because I'm always with an ear out for what joke can I clip for the end of the episode. And some episodes there's only one or two, and then some there's many, and I have to kind of pick. Well, all right, that one's really funny. And this was one of those. For such a heavy episode, there were a lot of jokes that I could pick from. So the one that I wanted to highlight as a favorite line is when Potter suggests that he and Klinger talk outside alone. He's like, let's step outside. And BJ laughs, but Klinger is worried. And he just says, Jamie Farr says in the most great, great drunken voice, oh God, BJ, he's going to beat me up. He's like a little kid. And Colonel Potter is going to beat him up. I just, the line read Jamie Farr gives that is just makes me laugh every time. He just got up with the
biggest brown puppy dog eyes you've
ever
seen.
Unbelievable. He still has them. You meet him today. He's like Jamie Farr's like 92 years old. You meet him today and he still has those big puppy dog eyes. It's unbelievable. So, well, whew, Molly, baby.
Oh my God.
Molly, it must be, I mean, Phoebe, it must be like midnight where you are at this point.
It's 1:09 a.m.
1:09 a.m. That the commitment you two have brought to this is unbelievable. Thank you so much. Why don't you tell people where they can find you on Mash Blur if you so choose?
Molly, do you want to go first?
If you need to find me, you will.
Fair.
I'm not going to put my blog out there, but if Mash Blur calls to you and you hear the call, you will find me.
Choppers! So, okay. All right. Phoebe, do you want to remain equally mysterious or do you want to give out your handle?
You know, I this year when I started my rewatch, I it was quickly taking over my main blog. So I made a side blog specifically for MASH live blogging. And you can definitely find me there. It's beejwatch.tumblr.com. Right. That's where I'm doing thrilling stuff, like taking screenshots every time BJ wears his watch and posting them like it's breaking news. So come join me. It's really fun. Left wrist face out.
Left wrist face out.
I'm not even interested in doing this, but I wouldn't possibly criticize either one of you for the level of madness that you've brought to this, because I have now spent how many hours of my life recording podcasts about the show, and I have many more hours to go after this. I'm spending time. My poor dog is sitting here staring at me like, I got to go for a walk, and you're talking about this old TV show. So I appreciate the madness, the two of you, your fandom madness that you've brought to it. Cause I, you know, I relate to that. It's just in a very different way. And I really thank you for both coming on, Molly, for coming back, and Phoebe for coming on for the first time. I'm guaranteed this will not be, you'll be back. I can guarantee that.
Try and stop me.
There you go. Thank you so much. This was, I think, the longest episode of MASHcast we've recorded to this point. But it was an absolutely worthy discussion of the a really great episode. So thank you both for being here.
Thank you very much.
There's just too much to unpack with this episode. You know, it's all BJ's stuff comes spilling out, and we talked about all of it. And we just really appreciate you using, like, having the podcast and having an outlet for people to be able to gather around the show in, you know, and celebrate that fandom in whatever way, you know, they feel called to celebrate it. So,
well,
absolutely. Thank you too, Rob.
You're welcome. As we learned from BJ, it's got to come out, or it's going to come out in other ways, and it's not as healthy. So there you go. So anyway, thank you all for listening. I really appreciate if you've stuck with the show this far into the episode. You can, of course, find me over on Blue Sky and under Rob Kelly Creative. You can find all the back episodes of MASHcast on our website, findwaterpodcast.com. And if you want to support the Fine Water Podcast Network, of which MASHcast is a part, please go to patreon.com/FW podcast. And there you're going to lock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So big salute, as always, to Dennis Bailey, Darrell Clark, James K, Michael Kelly, David Mann, Matt McLean, Lisa P, Brady Palmer, Joe Perino, Stan Peel, Michael Porter, Nicholas Prom, Adam Sanders, Stefan Van Schaik, Rich Ram, Billy Shulman, and Mike Thomas. So, we will be back next week, everybody. But until then, that is all.
Any news? You see either of them?
No, Colonel.
No, but we have been regaled with glorious tales of their exploits. They are together, sparing you the sordid details. They are setting new standards for inebriate behavior. Additionally, we may be teetering on the brink of war with the Marines.